KUSF San Francisco!
I thought I had a lot of energy. Oh my goodness, are you in for a treat? And something we have never done before on this radio show, which is hand over 2 weeks to one artist. But that's what we're about to do for Jesse Malin. Because Jesse Malin has maybe twice as much energy as I have. And the rumor prior to the interview, based on a quote of his, is that he didn't like interviews. And so I went into my interview with him at the Hotel Phoenix prior to his concert here in San Francisco with a little bit of trepidation, headed to the Hotel Phoenix. And, well, I think we talked nonstop mostly him, ironically enough, for about 45 minutes, which is double what we usually do. And then the musical sandwich he created went on for, oh, I don't know, I could count the songs, but like 18 or 19 songs. And so I thought about it, and I turned to him at the end of the interview, and I said, we're doing 2 weeks. His new album, Glitter in the Gutter, is now out on a new label for him, Adeline Records. Some amazing folks on it. You've probably heard Broken Radio on a lot of radio stations because Bruce Springsteen is his cohort on that one. But Jesse comes out of punk rock, out of New York, been around a long time. Welcome to hour number one of this thing that I, Dennis the Menace, like to call Just Another Menace Sunday. Hour number one, interviews with rock and rollers of note. Hour number two, all new melodic rock and roll. We have lots of both, that's for sure. So let's head for the Phoenix Hotel just a few weeks ago for part number one of both my interview and musical sandwich with Jesse Malin on Just Another Menace Sunday.
I'm Jesse Malin. I'm from New York City.
Hello.
Let's set the tone for the interview. Whitestone Queens meet Jamaica Queens.
All right.
I was born in Jamaica Hospital. So there you go. So it's Whitestone meets Jamaica. So should we talk about Queens Boulevard for a half hour or the new record? What do you think?
Well, Queens Boulevard was interesting at the time, but right now I'm interested in the record. Queens Boulevard's changed a lot. But I worked at a gas station on Queens Boulevard when I was 14 and 15. I was in a band called Heart Attack, and I was very fascinated with the strip bars that were on Queens Boulevard. And
at the age of 14?
Yeah, we were trying to find ways to get in there. A place called Nichols, I think, and there was a few. And that was when Queens Boulevard was interesting. And also up by Forest Hills, I guess, I had some family up there. They had some good Knish places and movie theaters like this theater, the Midway. You could sneak into five movies and then jump the train to the city.
I know the Midway. The Midway was like 71st and like right off of...
Continental or something.
Continental, yeah. That's right. This is really dumb, right?
But so, I grew up in Flushing, Whitestone area. I was born in Flushing in Booth Memorial Hospital. So, but I know Jamaica, the E, the F train, the 7, it all collides and you funnel into the city. And that's when the city was fun city. It was something good to explore as a kid. Now it's a little different, but it's still there. And
It's been Giuliani'd.
Giuliani changed it, made it very much like the rest of America. You know, he used to go on tour.
Times Square is now like Disneyland.
The whole city. I mean, you know, there's still Chinatown. There's still Central Park. There's still like walk out your door and mixtures of clashing cultures of people running down the street and that high energy. But there's also like you get in Iowa at the strip mall. You got Subway and you got Kinko's and Applebee's and you got Duane Reade and there's the next block. And then you got, you know, that kind of thing that's been developed, I guess, post-Giuliani and handed over to Bloomberg. And now they want to take over the whole country like that and turn it into that kind of vibe. But I still look for the good things. People had to move back. Some places that we grew up in, like Queens and Brooklyn, that were places to get out of because they were closed-minded, Archie Bunker kind of ignorant, prejudiced places. You went to Manhattan to create, to be an artist, to be able to be free, to be able to live rent, you know, cheap rent. Now with CBGB's closed and clubs like The Bottom Line being bought up to NYU or Starbucks, it's definitely a different place. So people moving backwards, so places that we fought to get out of, now they're hip neighborhoods where it was just, you know, out in the kind of middle class suburban parts. Those are becoming where the nightclubs and cafes and vegetarian panties are.
And we're going to get back to the record. We will get to the record, but now that you brought it up, so I was at Trash Vaudeville buying my Ramon Stripe t-shirts about 3 weeks ago, because, you know, it's a requirement to have those as part of your rock and roll gear. And okay, the CBGB store on St. Mark's Place, the CBGB store, and I walked in there in a CBGB's t-shirt, $25.95.
And you probably can get that t-shirt at Urban Outfitters or
Bloomingdale's
chain, and it's out there, it's a branding. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people walking around probably that don't know what it even means. Like when I was a kid, I'd look at these shirts that said Hard Rock Cafe, and I didn't know what that was. I thought it was just some shirt that people thought looked cool. And I guess that happens, but... you know, the CBGB's thing, I think, has permeated a lot of kids in the culture, and I think hopefully, like I was when I was a kid, if I heard about something, I'd want to, like, look it up and learn who produced that record or where these people were from or what came before that or what influenced. If I liked the Dead Boys, then I found the Stooges. If, you know, it just was that line backwards. And, like, with the internet, you can do that. Hopefully kids are. You know, I'm very into people coming out to rock shows and being present as much as online is an information highway of sorts. I think the human contact is still important. That's why I like living in New York even to this day, because of that you have that impact of a lot of people in a small area and you're forced to deal with it socially. It's not like Los Angeles or other parts of America where you got to drive everywhere to get your toilet paper or even to, you can't live spontaneously.
It's true.
I like the spontaneous living and the metropolis, but I also enjoy touring because you get to see the world like the Army, but you don't have to kill anybody. Well, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. At the end of your MySpace site was one of the influences I must get into, Tennessee Tuxedo. Now, I think I heard the Tennessee Tuxedo theme riff deep in one of the tracks on Glitter in the Gutter. Am I mistaken or am I correct here?
It might be in there. You know, all those shows, that Underdog cartoon just had all those great little spin-offs. And people would say to me, well, what do you like and what are you interested in? What influenced you, you know, what literature or whatever? I'd say everything from Tennessee Tuxedo to Tennessee Williams. And it's kind of true. But, you know, there was some kind of hyper-crazy energy about that big Walrus Chumley and Don Adams voice doing Tennessee Tuxedo.
That's right. They talk like that.
Yeah, so those people go in the Wayback Machine and remember that. But they're always getting in trouble and find ways to break out of the zoo. And as a little kid, I was trying to find a way to break out of Queens or break out of the mold that was being forced on me by whatever school, TV, just the town. So I could always relate to wanting to jump over the wall and find myself, find something exciting.
You mainly recorded the new record in L.A. I think that's the first time you've recorded a record technically out of New York City. I counted a total of 10 recording studios involved in the making of this record. So tell me about Rob and Eddie and working with them in all these environments and the Anthrax factor and all of that. It's a new, you know, I mean, it's easy to say, well, you recorded this in L.A., but, you know, there was a lot here. You found your way to London and, you know, there's a lot. I think what I'm saying is this record, a lot went into it and it really shows big time.
There was 2 years between this record and the last one, The Heat.
Right.
You know, my first two I made pretty fast. I made the first record in 5 days, pretty live, like a punk record or a 50s record, everything, you know, on the floor, the whole band together. That's how Ryan Adams worked. Second record was written while I was touring the first one, which happens sometimes, and I produced it, which was, we had a few people in mind, and then we just started to do the demos, and we said, let's just keep going. So that record was made pretty much in between tours, and it really, looking back at the time, I thought, well, maybe it's my sophomore slump. I hope I don't hit that second record. When we were kids, you'd buy like the first Cars record, then we were like, the second record, what happened? The second Van Halen record, what happened? But somehow I thought I passed through it because it got good reviews, but looking back, I felt that I could have did a better job. But it's definitely a challenge to produce and star in the movie and direct the movie and sing on the record. And then Artemis Records was going out of business, and I was in between, so I wrote about 30 songs. I wanted to make the third record a step up. I wanted, like, tighter, leaner, more in your face, written more on the electric guitar. I went back to lots of my roots of stuff that inspired me as a kid, power pop stuff like Cheap Trick and the Ramones and the Dickies, and the mental attitude of bands like Bad Brains and Bob Marley and The Clash with more of a positive approach. I didn't want to have another My Girlfriend Left Me Crying in a Beer, you know, the world is ending kind of record. I felt there was enough fear in the world and people had just had enough suffering for 5 years, and there's a lot of uncertainty with the future of music and just lifestyle and even the planet, you know. So I felt that it needed to be a record that was about being in the moment, finding what your generation was, finding a way to celebrate that, not in some mindless disco escape, you know, turn off, tune out, but in a way to find what you could do at that time to make a difference in your moments of your life. And I guess I hooked up with this guy, Rob Caggiano, who was in Anthrax and was did a lot of metal production, Cradle of Filth, did a lot of weird things. But he said, I just want to do some demos on spec. And we went up to a place, Millbrook, New York, this Timothy Leary kind of weird town where it's just one street, very David Lynch. It says Pizza Place, and you walk in, it just says Pizza Place, and it says on the wall, the best pizza in town. It's the only pizza in town. And there's a Hitchcock mansion. But mostly it was pretty Blair Witch. We locked up there for like 2 days and came out with a 3-song demo. And I started shopping that around and had a little bit of money from Atlantic and Sony and some of these companies that were still trying to keep afloat. And I sent it out to Billy Joe Armstrong, who was on tour doing American Idiot and really doing well, playing the Enorma Domes. And I told him what was going on. He just checked in, and we were just talking. And he said, well, send it to me. You know, I'm taking Adeline to another level with my manager. And so I sent it to him, and he reacted really strong. And before we know it, they were playing Giant Stadium. We were having a meeting down the Village on Avenue A to talk about maybe doing something with Adeline. And during that time, I mean, that goes pretty fast, there was this 30-song build-up, a lot of demos. It wasn't a record, even though it was recorded in L.A., which I could get into. I wrote it all in New York in my apartment or down in a basement of this bar where I could write on the electric guitar and have the drummer bashing out beats and kind of riffing off each other to kind of give it a different thing as opposed to the Paul Simon sitting at a desk with an acoustic guitar and your typewriter, which I like too, but it was written to have more in-your-face kind of action, kind of live, made-to-be-played-loud record. And so we started thinking about producers, and I came to L.A. a few times, and I almost signed with Adeline Warner Brothers, and I almost made the record with Rob Cavallo, and I almost made it with a few other people, and just schedule-wise, so many other groups were doing stuff, I just felt like I couldn't wait. We waited a few months for Rob Cavallo. My Chemical Romance was coming up fast, and suddenly we just decided, hey, we worked out good with these producers, Eddie Wall and Rob Caggiano, even though they were these metal guys that kind of scared us a little bit in some ways. So let's just go back in and do it. So we went back to Millbrook, and we did the Blair Witch Isolation, a whole band up there with labeling their cereal boxes, don't touch this, is my soy milk, and all that, pajamas, woke up very focused, and did 2 weeks. And then after that, went back to the city to do a little stuff in Manhattan. Ryan put some really wild, weird, Ryan Adams, weird guitar stuff in a little studio in one afternoon, just said, play every track, and I'll just see what happens. And, you know, he always comes to the table with something different each time. It's like at school, you bring art class or show and tell, and he always
He's mercurial, to say the least.
Yeah, and he's been involved in all three records, and it's always completely different but wonderful. We did a day of that, and then we went out to L.A., which is where the label was, and the two producers lived out there, and I just lost my apartment to condos, part of the whole continuation of what we spoke about, gentrification, New York, Giuliani, Condoville, and I couldn't buy it, so I left, and they put me in a hotel on Sunset and Vine, got to rent a car, and I went to work every day, and I thought, maybe I'm supposed to move out here. A lot of my friends who had too many sodas or too many, you know, druggy candies or just wanted to have families or drive around, have a quieter life, and there's great music out there and great clubs and musicians, so I went out, did the record there for the whole summer of last summer. And I was pretty focused, but people say, well, you know, where's the L.A. influence? It's because by the time I got out of studio at 1:32 in the morning, the bars close early. I didn't know anybody up in the hills.
Right.
So I went to bed, and I was actually pretty focused as opposed to other records where I like to go out and see bands, hear DJs, talk to strangers, write on little bar napkins, scribble on my arm, and come up with more ideas and bring them in the next day. It was more like, let's just get this as tight and as strong as possible. And, you know, I wanted that kind of record that would be lean and to the point, but still have some of the lyrics and some of the details and atmosphere and environment that I like in songwriting and that I liked about my other records, but not make the same record. I like to make a progression with each record, so it still sounds like the same artist, but it's not like I made the same record, you know, 15 times, but worse, hopefully.
So you should know, though, that my audience thinks Mona Lisa is a big hit.
Yeah, that song, we felt, I guess it was a single. We did a fun little video with this guy, Jonathan Coet. He did a movie called Tarnation that really, I guess James Cameron had produced it. We really were hit by a very heavy film, if you ever can find it, Tarnation, and he directed the video. And Mona Lisa was a reaction to a lot of my friends in New York that used to have these cush jobs working for record companies and working in the media and TV, and now we're like selling weed to get by. It was like really a post-September 11th, but, you know, what are you doing about it? What are you doing with your life? And I think the line, hanging with the local talent, drinking like you're Shane McGowan.
Yep.
Brought one of my favorite writers, Shane McGowan, to his room to one of my shows in London, and he wanted to climb on stage and sing with me. And
he's really something else.
Yeah, he was drinking booze out of a Pringles can, and suddenly my roadie guy says, look, Shane's on the side of stage and wants to sing. I said, really, can he walk? Can he talk?
Yeah.
I said, what do you want to do? And he was like, rah, 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 rah. And then I said, well, I know two covers tonight with the band that you know well, Oliver's Army or Helpless by Neil Young, or, you know, we could do one of your songs. He said, Oliver's Army. And we switched on and off. I don't know what language he was singing or what words.
It didn't matter. It was Shane McGowan.
Elvis Costello probably would have approved. But, yeah, it was wonderful. So you name check somebody. Sometimes they'll end up in your end up on your stage.
There you go. So Broken Radio, which isn't a single here in the U.S., but it's really heating up in the U.K. I already just made the A-list on the BBC, which is no small feat on BBC One to get on the A playlist, because that means it's in heavy rotation. Why do you think you've always been more recognized in the UK first?
I
think you have. Would you agree to that?
Because I'm a big Hendrix and big... No, I think, yeah, it's true. My first record came out there 6 months earlier.
Right.
And they didn't know from me, like, from my other bands. I mean, not that my other bands were very big, but, like, Heart Attack when I was a kid or Degeneration were bands that were more or less cult status level. But over there, they didn't know them at all. So it was like, here's this guy from Mars. Here I just came, you know, from the David Bowie clouds into... You know, I landed as some kind of new artist. And One Indian had a good publicist, the label I was on over there. They sent it out to all the magazines, and somehow, I guess the record struck a chord in some way where Mojo and Uncut, and they have a lot more, at least at the time. I know we tried in this country to get magazines like Tracks and compete with having better music magazines. We have Harp and some other cool ones. But
we have a few, but there's, you can't compare.
Yeah, for years I was reading Mojo and Uncut and dreaming that, you know, someday I could be in there and they'd understand me. And with my last band, Degeneration, we were very misunderstood. You know, people thought we were...
They thought you were a glam band.
Some tribute to L.A., Poison, Cinderella, Sunset Strip. And meanwhile, we were more influenced by the Dolls and the Dead Boys and, you know, the Stooges and the Replacements. But, you know, it was one of those things. So I was always used to writing these songs that nobody cared about. They always want to talk about the shoes and the eyeliner or whatever. And finally, you know, the critics were listening to the record, and for the most part, they were getting where I was coming from, and the record was making a difference. And then because, I guess, you know, Ryan was such a pal and such a supporter, going out with him for 6 weeks all through Europe was really just an experience where suddenly I'm playing to 3,000 people a night. I'm alone with an acoustic guitar. He wouldn't let me bring a band or a piano player. I'm scared to death, but I'm brushing up on my comedy because I have to have something to say while I'm tuning my guitar.
The in-between banter, yeah.
So that was it. And then finally, Danny Goldberg signed me to Artemis, and that came out in January, early February, on on Artemis Records. So people in America had kind of that read those magazines and the Tastemaker people, and you know, had already kind of bought the record and already was percolating, but from over there, and it just seemed to be a thing that I had started this audience there, and they were giving me such love. And after so many years of not finding a place to be appreciated or be able to play and make a living, I started going over there a lot. So I did that for a while, and then we started focused on America. And with this record, I think that was more of the goal too, being on a stronger, you know, U.S. label that actually was, you know, first time with them. And just this tour I'm on right now is like 6 weeks of just doing
the
States.
It's a long tour, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we've been putting a lot more into it here. Because, I mean, you know, one of the things that happened to me from touring, I guess, was to look at the world more globally and see that, you know, you write a song in your little crappy apartment down in the Lower East Side, but there's some guy in Finland that can relate to it, and there are people singing along in some other country. It's kind of, it changes the way you look at everything, and you travel that much, it doesn't seem so scary and so big. You realize how connected we are, and then you start getting asked all these questions about your government and what we're doing and what this guy's doing, and you feel somewhat responsible, even though as a rock and roll person, I figure it's a given that I'm not supporting that guy and
that
regime.
Right.
But, you know, there's some things that need to be cleared up, and we were out touring during a lot of the times of the Friendship Fries and the Iraq War and all the different things that went on, and you watch the different reactions of people, especially in Europe. So a lot of that's too a view of being an outsider. I always relate to that Iggy Pop song, like The Passenger, like when I'm writing, like looking at the world through a window, kind of taking things in and being that stranger. Because in New York, I know a lot of people, and you're a big fish in that small pond. It's like Cheers, everyone, you know, slapping your back. It's a small little town. But to go away and kind of be in a city where you don't know where the record shops are, where people might know you, and walk and be, you know, in transit or take the systems and the subways and the buses, and kind of have that place to reflect, is where I get a lot of ideas for writing. Because when you feel more vulnerable, I think you're more stripped down. And when you're in a place where you're really, everyone's just giving you free drinks, and you can just get lost in it and not be as perceptive to that antenna of sensitivity.
And speaking of a little bit of politics, you shot the video for Broken Radio in Tompkins Square Park, which is certainly, to those of us who know, very, very symbolic. And then you went to the farmlands of New Jersey. Now, I take it wasn't North Caldwell, right?
No, that wasn't a Sopranos thing, but it was close. Yeah, you know, we talked about Sopranos. You know, it's like a few times I've been around Bruce, I always like try to pick his brain. But we went to his farm. It was the first day, and he's got all these beautiful horses, and there's this barn there. And Danny Clinch, who directed it, has done some stuff with Bruce. He's a great photographer. He had this idea. So we spent the afternoon, you know, playing a song, and you try to lip sync, and I don't think Bruce lip syncs anything in his videos. I think he always does them live since the last 15 years or whatever. But we were lip syncing, but we end up just singing and jamming, and it was a real fun afternoon. Did that with him, and then the next day had all my friends and locals did something down in the park down on Avenue A, and Handsome Dick Manitoba from the Dictators came by. I was like, get in the cab, you're gonna be the cab driver. and he, you know, drops this girl there. She's building a radio, putting together, trying to fix an old radio to make some kind of connection. And all these people, it was kind of inspired by almost like Wings of Desire, the Wim Wenders film, and everybody, these angels giving her a part for this radio to put together. And my friend Max, who's from the San Francisco area, from Swingin' Utters, is in there with some stuff, his arms. And the opening of the film, the video.
The mini film,
the mega, you know, digital download, is this guy Giorgio Gomelsky does a soundbite. And he's a guy who, if you look in the rock history books, you know, produced the Yardbirds, managed the Stones for a while. He's in all the Zeppelin books, named Eric Clapton, Slowhand. He's this Russian, Jewish, French, English, you know, Svengali of a guy who had a loft on 24th Street when I was growing up and needed a place to rehearse, a place to throw hardcore gigs or to throw Green Door parties or to, you know, whatever, throw up. I pretty much would go to him, and he'd rent this place out, and he still does. And that's kind of what got me into the idea of, you know, if you don't want to work a straight job and you still can't pay your bills from being in a band, You could maybe DJ, or you could throw a party and throw beers at people and charge $2, and, you know, kind of that there's other ways to do it, and, you know, put your own gigs on, and as long as they don't break the toilets up too much, it's all right. But he opens the video talking about radio, and it's just really cool because a lot of people don't know who he is, but he's such a big part of the early days of rock and roll in the 60s and stuff. And so I'm proud of the video. I think Danny Clinch did a good job, you know, regarding whatever, if I wasn't in it or Bruce wasn't in it or whatever, it still looks nice. Because we've been making videos for a while, and usually they don't come out like with the director plans. That you get a treatment, and then you get the video, and you're like, "What? What was he talking about? This doesn't look like that."
So, what I think it's important to clear the record, pun intended, the fact that your association with Bruce goes way back. You've been involved in tributes, you know, tribute albums. You've been involved in a lot of other things way before Bruce came aboard on this record.
Yeah, he actually was somebody that I got into when I was getting out of hardcore and I was looking for other songwriters. I felt that the hardcore thing in the mid-80s was becoming very Nazi skinhead, very heavy metal, very just closed-minded, everything I felt it was against. So I started listening to other writers like Billy Bragg and Graham Parker and Paul Weller, and just craving that kind of thing. And my dad, I'd never been a Bruce fan growing up in the Tri-State area. I always thought he was singing about girls sitting on cars with warm beer and, you know, beards. And and it was just not my thing with these big bombastic songs. I wanted Kiss, I wanted the Ramones, and I wanted to break my room up. And so finally I was ready for it. My dad gave me Nebraska, and he said, check this out. It was on vinyl. And here's this guy who's this millionaire, and I sat down with the lyrics, and it was very stark and real and cinematic and dealing with fugitives and losers and people trying to better themselves through hard times in the 80s, and it hit me. So I became a fan, and was even a fan through Born in the USA, while my friends that were into the Dead Kennedys were laughing at me, and I was laughing back. So when we finished Fine Art of Self-Destruction, fast forward to 2002, you know, I just had a feeling. I said to my manager, I hope, you know, at the end of the year, I'd love Bruce just to hear this record, because people like him and Neil Young and some other writers really got me through the end of the degeneration thing and inspired me to write and focus more on lyrics. So the end of the year, the end of the touring process, he called up. They said, oh, Bruce is going to call you. And I'm like, what? He's going to call you at home. So he called to say that he loved the record and that he wanted me to do some shows with him down in Asbury Park. We did a week of shows, benefit shows for a local charity.
Right.
His band backed me up with Nils and Max Weinberg, and they played my songs and he played his songs, and it was a pretty wild, dreamlike thing. And from then, we stayed in touch. Whenever he'd play New York, or if I was in town in L.A. or somewhere, we'd, you know, hook up at the show, and he'd call once in a while, invite me to a rehearsal, and it was just super cool. And he loves to talk music, and what are you listening to, and what's going on. He's very passionate and present, and so I went to see him play at the Pete Seeger Sessions thing last spring up in Massachusetts, and it was a great show, like the Pogues.
Great album, too.
Yeah, like Pogues meets Springsteen meets, like, Pete Seeger, you know.
Right.
So I went backstage and just told him I thought it was a wonderful night, and he said, what's going on with you? And I said, well, I'm starting my record in a week in L.A., and it's a third record. And he said, well, congratulations, and if something comes up, you know, I'd love to do something on it.
So the last thing we do to fill up the hour, and Being You Like Songs, and 100 people have played with me on this, we do a musical sandwich. So we take two of your songs as the bread, and then you get to put anything else you want in between by other artists, and no matter what you tell me, I am now under moral obligation to play it exactly as you give it to me.
All right. I want Promised Land by Chuck Berry.
Right.
I want The Obvious Child by Paul Simon.
Yeah, and by the way, I was going to ask you about that Mother and Child reunion cover that you did with Pete. That's pretty wild, too.
Oh, yeah. That's I'm a big fan. Queens, you know.
I
like
how
drag
could you
queens.
Not?
I like the Ramones. I like Perry Farrell. I like people from Queens. And, you know, I like Paul Simon a lot.
There
a lot of
go.
His writing. I don't know if I'd get along with him personally, but I was in a movie with his son once, and that was kind of
wow.
fun, but he was drinking a lot.
Not to spoil the flow here, so keep going.
Yeah, anyway, we're getting off Paul Simon. So, The Obvious Child by Paul Simon. Then I'd like to have Sunny Side of the Street by the Pogues. Then I'd like to have You Can Make Them Like You by Hold Steady.
Nice.
Then I'd like Going to a Town by Rufus Wainwright. Then I'd like It Shook Me by Graham Parker. I'd like to have Classic Girl by Jane's Addiction. I'd love to have Sonic Reducer by the Dead Boys. And, how many more do I get in this?
You got a
this
few
a big
more.
Sandwich. All right,
you got a
I'll
few
keep
more.
Going.
You only get the lettuce, man.
Death or Glory by The Clash.
Nice.
I'd like to have The Man by Pete Yorn. And I'd like to have West by Lucinda Williams. And it's now I'm getting a little mellow into the sandwich,
yes.
getting into the alfalfa
yes.
sprouts
yes.
and the, you
yes.
know,
this is
the
LA.
Avocado.
You went from the New York sandwich. Now we're kind of like in the Toluca Lake sandwich.
All right, I'm going to work my way out. This one might, maybe you'll be able to find this. I'd like to get Romeo by the Wipers.
Sure.
Out in Portland, up in that way. And then I'd like to get Little Mascara by the Replacements. Working my way back home. And then, let's see, Take a Letter, Maria.
Barbie Graves.
Yeah, that's her sings it. All right, yeah. We'll get that in there. And then I'd like Gypsies, Tramps, and Thieves by Cher. Then we're going to move down into Detroit, and I want to have Down on the Street by the Stooges as the sun starts to go down.
Yes.
And the pants start to get tighter and the heat goes up. Then I'd like to move over, I guess, into, let's say, Love Train, you know, by the style, wait,
OJ's.
The Spinners. No, the OJ's. Love Train going into Pennsylvania, Philadelphia area. And then let's see what else. Let's see. Lies by the Knickerbockers. We'll go into New Jersey, and then we're going to work our way to the Ramones, back into Queens with Rockaway Beach, because the summer's here. Then Here Comes the Summer by the Undertones.
What are your two songs here?
Oh, my two songs I'm going to put in there?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, boy. I guess Prisoners of Paradise and Wendy. Just keep some power on each end of it. Keep a little rock. Wendy from the first album, Prisoners of Paradise, from Glitter in the Gutter.
Down. Sure as you're born, they bought me a silk suit and put luggage. from high over Albuquerque on a jet to the promised land. When the pilot told us in 13 minutes he would set us at the terminal gate. Swing low, the chariot, come down easy, taxi to the terminal zone. Cut your engines and cool your wings and let me make it to the telephone. Los Angeles, give me Norfolk, Virginia, Tidewater, 14-09. Tell the folks back home this is the promised land calling and the pool boy's on the line.
I'm going to a place that has already been described. make it up for all of the nursery rhymes that never really seem to want to tell the truth. I'm so tired of you, America, making my own way home. Ain't gonna be alone. I got a life to live, America. I got a life. Soaking the body of Jesus Christ in blood, I'm so tired of America. I really need to know. I may just never see you again, or might as well. You took advantage of a world that loved you well. I'm going to a town that has already been burnt down. I'm so tired of you, America, making my own way home. Ain't gonna be alone. I got a life to live, America. I got a life. Shaking now. I
brothers hammering their own coffin nails. I just read how universes start. Continually they blow apart, and it shook me, and I'm still shaking now. Some believe
Well, there you go. Part one of our two-part interview with Jesse Malin and his musical sandwich. A lot of songs to go in part two of that one. We'll have the shorter second half of the interview and more music next week. But in his musical sandwich, part number one, from Glitter in the Gutter, his new album out on Artemis Records, Modern World, Jane's Addiction, Classic Girl, Graham Parker, and It Shook Me, Rufus Wainwright, Going to a Town, The Hold Steady, You Can Make Them Like You, The Pogues, The Sunny Side of the Street, Paul Simon from Rhythm of the Saints, Obvious Girl, Chuck Berry, Promised Land, and again from Glitter in the Gutter, the latest by Jesse Malin, Prisoners of Paradise. Again, we will have hour number two in hour number one of the Jesse Malin interview next week on Just Another Man of Sunday. Meanwhile, if you have any questions, any thoughts, any recipes for New York pizza, please send them to Dennis, D-E-N-N-I-S, at menaceattic.com, M-E-N-A-C-E-A-T-T-I-C.com. We will be back with our hour number two, New Melodic Rock and Roll, right after we do something good.
Do you know what hell is?
Homelessness in San Francisco and across the country is real and growing. The Coalition on Homelessness is a community organization committed to making tangible improvements in the lives of the homeless. Coalition goals combine short-term solutions with long-term strategies to change social and economic justice both locally and nationally. The Coalition on Homelessness welcomes your time, money, and interest, so please contact the Coalition on Homelessness at 346-3740 to find out more.
It's time for hour number one. Did I say hour number one? Do some more drugs, Dennis. Hour number two of this thing that I, Dennis the Menace, call Just Another Menace Sunday, New Melodic Rock and Roll. I say this every week. Giant stack of CDs in the studio to choose from. And we will. So without further ado, Mr. Engineer, would you please hit CD number two right now?